Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another playoff bubbly episode. Man, it has been an unbelievable playoff stretch in Orlando, down in the bubble. I was talking about it with some people the other day. You know, is this the best NBA playoffs that we can remember? What when you think of like great years that have had NBA playoff stretches that have been incredibly entertaining, what years jump out? Certainly 2016, everything happening, second round series in the West, the conference finals, the finals. That was an incredible playoff run. And there have been other years. 2010, I thought, had a lot with Nash finally, you know, blitzing through the Spurs, and then that classic series that the Lakers and the Suns had out West, the Celtics upending the Cavs in the East, then the Orlando series, then the Lakers and the Celtics having that seven-game brouhaha. That thing, boy, that got intense and ugly by the end of the series. And I think that game seven, kind of people think, oh, you know, that was some ugly basketball. Well, the whole series wasn't like that. The playoffs certainly had more entertainment quality to them than that game seven. So that was a great playoffs. 2006 had some interesting things happen. I think the common denominator, by the way, between this year, 2010 certainly, 2006 is another one of those years, there really isn't a super team. I've tweeted about this before, where your immediate thought is, well, we have more parity. And yes, I do think you get more parity. I do think you have more opportunities for teams to win just other than the juggernaut or the two favorites. You know, we had the Cavs and the Warriors playing each other in more sequels than Sylvester Stallone suiting up for Rocky Balboa. So, you know, that is a part of it. But I also think the other thing, which I love, is when you look at luck in basketball, when you look at variance, three-point shooting, hot shooting, whatever it is, determining the outcome of a game or a series, which can easily happen. I've written about this before. The number of times the quote-unquote better team wins the series is way, way smaller than you think. And a lot of that is this shooting luck that, you know, you hit 50% of your threes in a series. The one that I always remember that first turned me on to this was 2009, not 2010, 2009, with the Magic when they beat the Cavs. At that point in time, three-point shooting still hadn't had the sort of recent explosion that we've seen it have. And if you go back and look at the Magic wins in those series, one of the things they did was stretch the floor, play more four out around Dwight Howard. And when you had Hedo Turkoglu and Rashard Lewis as your forwards, they were both very good shooting forwards. In fact, Stan Van Gundy, somewhat brilliantly at the time, had Turkoglu initiate a lot of pick and roll because he could pass and ball handle from that position. And all these things really stressed the more traditional defense and lineups of the Cavs with two bigs on the court and things like that. And so, long story short, in those wins, they created a lot of open three-point shots, and they hit a lot of open three-point shots. Off the top of my head, I want to say it was a really high volume for the period and like 41, 42% three-point shooting as a team. And when you've got close games in that series, as there were buzzer beaters and overtime games and things like that, that will flip the outcome of the series. Well, how does that relate back to my point about parity? In basketball, if you have a huge discrepancy between two teams, it takes a lot of luck to overcome that discrepancy. But when teams are, you know, let's say to put wins on it, when they're the difference between a true 55-win team and a true 50-win team, it doesn't take as much luck. When you're a 57-win team playing a 53-win team, it doesn't take as much luck. And I think that's some of what we're seeing, certainly this season in those other landscapes. I'll bring up a few more in a second. But when you think of a playoffs that has surprises and teams getting hot, and it's very difficult to pinpoint a favorite, and certainly this year in Orlando with the environment, it has that feeling of March Madness, where, you know, the one seeds are off the board, wipe out your bracket, it's getting messed up, things like that. And I think that comes from having really good teams that aren't great, having teams that have different strengths and different kinds of versatility. I've talked about how those Eastern Conference teams very much seem to have different options from series to series. So I think that's all there, and that's part of what is making this such a great tournament. We'll get to the East and the West finals coming up and my thoughts on them and some of what I think we can look forward to, especially in the Denver-LA series, which is going to tip tonight. But before we get into that, a reminder that this podcast is brought to you by The Athletic. If you go to theathletic.com/thinkingbasketballpod, that's the link to help support the show. You know, it lets them know that you've listened to this pod successfully and then signed up. You can get 40% off your subscription price there, which means you basically, if you get the annual subscription, you get all of their basketball coverage, national coverage, local team coverage for a couple bucks. My last few videos have been about the Celtics. I did a lot of Celtics deep diving this month where we had Tatum and then what happened in the Toronto-Boston series, which was really complicated and incredible. And for instance, the Celtics, a local writer for The Athletic, Jared Weiss, I mean, he's just done spectacular film room breakdowns there. So they have a variety of basketball coverage for everyone. TheAthletic.com/thinkingbasketballpod, 40% off. Check them out. You help the show. Okay. I did want to discuss something about the All-NBA Awards. Well, actually, before we do the All-NBA Awards, let me, because I know people are going to ask about it. I don't know what the best, most exciting, my favorite all-time NBA playoff tournament was. I do know in the conversation that I was having the other day, we really focused on like the last 30 years and change when I've been watching live NBA playoff brackets. And 1995 was the one that jumped out to me. That's, again, Jordan comes back from baseball, so you don't have that dominant Chicago Bulls team. Again, you didn't really have a dominant team in that tournament, but for younger viewers, I'm not on the channel right now, I'm on the podcast. For younger listeners who aren't familiar with that tournament, that was Hakeem Olajuwon versus David Robinson, then Hakeem and the Rockets as underdogs upsetting Shaq and Orlando and the young Penny Shaq group in the finals. That was Reggie Miller, 8 points in 9 seconds over the Knicks in the second round. Then the Pacers and the Magic right after that in the conference finals played a legendary series. Houston was actually one of the lower seeds, so they had to go through like 3 or 4 60-win teams. It was just ridiculous. They played a 5-round series against the Jazz that was right down to the end. Then they were down 3-1 against the Suns. So that was my pick for the craziest tournament that I can remember in the NBA playoffs. But again, it kind of had that same thing where maybe matchups and styles make the fight, and maybe you don't have a dominant team, and that's what makes the whole field and the whole thing more entertaining and feel more wide open. Okay, before we get to the actual Eastern and Western playoffs, the All-NBA teams were announced this week. And just for posterity, let me read off those teams. First team, Giannis Antetokounmpo, LeBron James, James Harden, Anthony Davis, Luka Doncic. That was the first team. The only two players in the league, unanimous first team votes, were Giannis and LeBron. I think that makes a lot of sense. By the way, people have asked, am I going to do a top 10 list at the end of the year? Yes. That is the plan. We will have a top 10 list right around the end of the finals. Not sure if it'll be before the season or after, but as the season wraps and you sort of get to the end of the tournament, I feel pretty solidified in what I've seen from different guys, and we will publish that. That'll be out on the Thinking Basketball YouTube channel at some point near the end of the season. Back to business here. Second team, All-NBA, Kawhi, Jokic, Pascal Siakam, Damian Lillard, and Chris Paul. And the third team, the forwards were Tatum and Butler, Ben Simmons and Westbrook at the guards, and Rudy Gobert at the center position. Now, a lot of complaints about these. I actually think for the most part, the voting, especially on the defensive awards, is pretty good. You know, there are problems that you can nitpick always. I think there are certain voters that, you know, I'm not sure what they're thinking or if they're just not familiar with other players. You can always look at problems like that. But I think for me, at least, if you look at all defensive voting 10 or 15 years ago compared to now, I just thought the general shape of the voting was much smarter and the misses weren't as glaring or big. When it comes to all NBA, again, I think they did a pretty good job here just in terms of, you know, not being wildly out of line in most cases. And the case I wanted to bring up is Russell Westbrook, specifically because I think this version of Westbrook, and I want to be clear here, this is not an indictment or something that I think really applies to his prior years. So this is not peak Russell Westbrook anymore. It's this version of Westbrook that's a little older and can't really shoot anymore. He was never a great shooter, but at least he had some component to his game where back in the day when teams took more mid, you know, even just 5 years ago when teams took more mid-range jumpers, that was an alternative for him to get to that spot, get that quick pull-up jumper, and blend that in with the rest of his game, specifically his rim pressure, his passing, things like that. So he's never really been great off ball, but I think the idea of Russell Westbrook this year is kind of at its extreme. It's kind of at its max. Like, people who are in the camp of being pro-Westbrook have him in a situation where not only can he put up big numbers in Houston because of the context and the scheme that they have, five out, extra spacing, attack, 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 but the people who are naysayers can point to that and say, look, there's nothing additive when he plays with James Harden. And in the playoffs, when you get to situations where we can scheme against you, when you get to better defenses, things like this, he can really be a problem playing next to James Harden because he can't shoot, he can't space the floor. He's the guy you sag off of. I mean, multiple teams have now gone to this move where they put their center on him. And I think that's the epitome of what I'm talking about with this version of Westbrook, where in the old days you couldn't do that, especially in a situation like Houston, because there'd probably be too many ways to hurt you and he could shoot. And now it's like he really just needs to get to the rim. And he's still great at getting to the rim. His burst and his downhill acceleration and the pressure he can put on you at times getting to the rim in the right situation. You know, he's got extra space in Houston and things like that. I mean, there are few players in the league that have had that high-end ability. And even though he's, you know, not at his athletic peak anymore and things like that, he still has that, especially in certain moments where he's healthy and clicking and everything like that. So with all that said, I'm fascinated by this vote, Westbrook on the third team. And let's see, how many votes did he get? He got 0 first place votes. He got 9 second place votes. So there are 9 voters who, let's just say, the term I'm thinking of is seduction by production. Seduction by production. So you look at what he's able to do in Houston, especially after they switched to micro ball in January, end of January, trading away their bigs and putting Covington on the court. And you say, wow, I'm seeing 25 to 30 point games. I'm seeing the efficiency go up. I'm seeing him shoot fewer threes. And he's taking, like, you know, a couple threes a game tops and hitting them in the low 30s. So that's not bad. And then I look at the whole, I know he's a good rebounding guard. And so I'm seeing the triple doubles. I'm seeing the stat line at the end of the year for Westbrook, 27 points per game. That's his highest since his MVP season where he averaged a triple double. And you add in, you know, 8 rebounds and 7 assists per game. Now, still only about 54% true shooting. That's a couple percentage points on the wrong side of the league average. but it's his, you know, it's his best kind of statistical look since 2017. And I think in the most generous interpretation of that, what you could argue is, well, Westbrook still has this ability to provide value on offense without being too damaging on defense. You know, maybe when he engages, and I saw him at times and he looked better on defense and he's moving around, and okay, so he's not a negative, so he's maybe around a neutral, or you want to talk yourself into something more. Leave that side of the ball alone for a second. On offense, he could help a team and kind of be a centerpiece and an engine, and his rim pressure and shot creation still causes problems, and he can get downhill and score. Get to the line a lot. In fact, Westbrook without James Harden this year, I mean, these numbers are really interesting. Well, I have it since small ball. That was for the Houston video. I pulled these numbers. So it's right before the LA series, from like January to the end of August. With James Harden this year in that stretch, Westbrook, 26 points per 75, 55% true shooting, and then estimates of shot creation using my box creation metric, about 7 shots he sets up per 100 for teammates by drawing defensive attention. That's pretty good. But without Harden, those numbers go to 32 points per 75, 56% true shooting, so about the same, but the volume goes up, and now we're talking about a guy maybe around league average. And he does everything. He carries the load again. This is similar to how he played in Oklahoma City after Durant left. It's similar to how he played in Oklahoma City when Durant was there. And he set up 15 shots per 100. The team's offensive rating when he played with James Harden was 114. When he played without him, it was about 112. Side note, when Harden was out there without Westbrook, it was 117. And I think that's sort of the criticism here. But all those numbers, to me, fit into the same story. Westbrook is a guy. I mean, think about scalability, portability. If you're a regular listener of this show, or you've read Thinking Basketball, the book, you know this is something that I've championed over the years, the difference between floor raising and ceiling raising. Well, in this case, we might have the most extreme player ever who has floor raising value. But if you think about how well he holds his value on better and better teams, it slips away drastically. Like, it's not a gentle curve, which most players have. And the discussion I tend to have when we talk about higher level, sort of all-star level players and above is, well, yeah, you can't make a 40-win team a 60-win team. But man, if you can keep holding your value and be additive on a 55 or 60 win team, that's really important. It's the Klay Thompsons of the world. If you can be a great second option, a great third option. Here we have the exact opposite. We have the inverse situation. We have a guy who I think you can still make a generous best case scenario argument for. If you put him back on a 30 win team, if you tried to build a team around his ability to get to the rim, kind of like what the Bucks have with Giannis, you could see a player who has pretty good value on that team. Like, without him, those guys don't do very well. But when he's out there, they can compete. They can win, pick your number, 38 games, 44 games, 46 games. Very similar to what we saw a couple years ago with the idea of Westbrook helping a sort of weaker OKC team in 2017 to get his MVP. But I want to be clear again, this is not to connect this Westbrook to his career specifically. It's just to say that this version of this player might be the most extreme example of diminishing returns, of non-scaling, of floor raising that maybe I've ever seen in basketball. It's a really interesting example. So when it comes to all NBA, there could be people out there making that argument, hey, leave your championship equity at the door, leave your playoff stuff at the door. This is a regular season award. And I understand that maybe he's not super valuable to Houston, but the way he played in Houston reminds me of what happened in Oklahoma City. And you can see it, you know, when Harden wasn't on the court, he puts up these big numbers. Okay, things happen. And therefore, when I start doing my ballot, I'm going to include him over other people. Now, how much of that is that seduction by production I alluded to earlier? Probably a decent amount in most cases. But I'm thinking of something more abstract here. Just this idea that there is a player that could really be that extreme in terms of having value up to 30, 35, 40, 45 wins, and then just falling off a cliff. Because how does he fit with better players? What is it about him that actually helps when you put him next, the second you put him next to another ball dominant player, does basically all his value go out the window? I mean, I think the people who are naysayers against Westbrook will argue that he basically is a negative out there. And I think that is also a valid perspective when you look at it from the ceiling raising angle, that he basically bleeds out most of his value, if not all of it. If not, you know, you can see people reasonably saying on really good teams, he could become a negative, because what things does he do well? For instance, one of the things I was looking for this year was his extra passing or his short roll passing. And I thought he basically struggled with it for most of the year. He was trying to do a lot at times when Harden was off the court, different reads, different teammates, not the same spread pick and roll stuff, not the same dance partners. He got used to and sort of learned the angles of in Oklahoma City. And his passing numbers plummeted. His turnover numbers spiked in certain situations. When Harden was on the bench, he actually had basically the highest turnover percentage in my metric in the league. So you get these two very extreme things. And on one hand, it's a philosophical discussion to say which one is right, which one is more valuable. How do you construct your all-NBA team based on that? But on the other one, it's just interesting to see someone who 9 people thought he was second team All-NBA. 9 people. If you're one of those 9 listening to this show, please reach out. I'm fascinated by that angle. And then on the flip side, you have people who are saying, you know, Westbrook's not a top 40 or top 50 player, and then getting backlash, where I think you can make a pretty clear argument that this is a guy who isn't going to help a lot of playoff teams. And that's not good for your ranking, you know, in the league, where you stand in the league. But on the flip side, he can probably do more stuff, this version of Westbrook, with a poor team around him. If you just put some role players and maybe some decent 3-point shooters, and you kind of do like a poor man's version of what everything looks like in Milwaukee, I could see that making that Westbrook look pretty good. By the way, biggest snub to me by far, Chris Middleton. I think he's closer to a second team All-NBA player than not being on this team. He did receive enough votes to make the team. There's kind of a weird thing happening. I don't know what's going on. He received 82 points, 10 second place votes, 52 third place votes, or second team and third team, excuse me. And those 82 points are more than Westbrook, who had 56. They're more than Simmons, who had 61. But I guess because he was designated as a forward with the majority of the votes he received, then he had to compete with Tatum and Butler, and Tatum and Butler had more votes. I don't know. This whole thing seems a little strange. There was definitely some positional hacking with different ballots, and maybe the league has to take care of this, but Chris Middleton, to me, biggest snub. I want to return. Someone asked me about it recently when Giannis was injured in the Miami series. I had mentioned Middleton's numbers without Giannis on the court earlier this season. The final numbers this year, including the playoffs, Middleton averaged 29 points per 75, created 12 shots per 100, had a passer rating of 7. He's a really nice passer. I think you can see that when you watch him both off-ball and on-ball pretty clearly, I hope. 59% true shooting. The Bucks had a 115 offensive rating when he was on and Giannis was off. They were +6 in nearly 1,000 minutes. I just think the guy is fantastic. I thought he showed when Giannis was out in the Miami series how good he can be, where if you asked him to be the number one guy in a championship level situation against high level defenses, you'll get a little struggle. You know, it's not ideal, but really good kind of number two player. So he was my biggest snub from the All-NBA team. All right, let's get to the Eastern and Western playoffs. Let's start with the East. As of recording this, the Heat lead the Celtics 2-0. Now, it's always weird, I think, to record thoughts mid-series like this and even just listen to them, you know, a week later, let alone a month later or something of that nature. But mid-series right now, I do think we can talk about that series based on the perspective of the whole series, which is coming in, I at least thought that the Heat were going to show some zone. And the Celtics aren't a great zone offense by reputation. I don't think statistically they're closer to the bottom of the league, at least according to Synergy's classification of zone offense. And they didn't have great success against the Raptors' zone offense, but the Raptors' zone defense is a very different animal than the Heat zone defense. The Heat zone defense, which has had great success in the first two games, and I think probably the key to the series is whether the Celtics can crack it. And I don't mean to overly dichotomize that either, in the sense that, you know, maybe there's not some huge thing and all of a sudden they destroy the zone every time Miami goes to the zone. I don't think that's it. But there were major issues the Celtics had going against that zone in games 1 and 2. A reminder, by the way, the Celtics were up by like 12 in the fourth quarter in game 1, 5 with a minute to go. And Tyler Mega Chutzpah Hero just drained a three-pointer to cut it to 2. Butler hit the tying shot in the corner. Heat snatched that game in overtime. You go to game 2, Boston had early success. They definitely had stretches of success on both sides of the ball, but 17-point lead this time in the second quarter, drained with a huge third quarter Miami run, and again, another close game going to the Heat. Now, if the Heat are just going to be more likely to win close games because of their personnel and sort of because of their makeup as a team, that's one thing. But I think what we've seen instead is we've got two very closely matched teams that the matchup makes it competitive. It's a slightly better matchup in Miami's favor, I think precisely because of this zone. I expected zone and I did not expect it to be this effective. The key to this thing, which is like an amoeba, is they put the tall athletes at the top of the zone. So Jimmy Butler, long, big, rangy guard, or I guess he's a forward according to the All-NBA team, and you'll see like Derek Jones Jr. up there, Crowder. They put those guys up at the top, and they're aggressive up at the top. They're willing to leave a spot to get into a gap to help on the other side or in the middle. They'll jump passes up there, as we saw that at the end of the game last night, and how key that kind of dynamic was down the stretch. And the other thing this allows them to do, my initial thought was, we'll definitely see more zone, and one of the reasons we'll see more zone is so the Celtics can't attack players like Duncan Robinson. And so when you go to the zone, the way the Heat do it by keeping people high is on the wings. You put Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero on the wings, it allows you to play them at the same time on the court more securely based on defense. And they tend to be a little higher, right? So if you imagine two spots on the wing, they're up closer to the free throw line on the side of the court that they're on, one on each side, versus being down in the corner where a shooter may position himself. So if you're the Celtics, you can space the court the way you want to and put shooters in the corner, but the Heat will keep those lesser athletic guys up a little higher to kind of prevent them from having to come so far. It's a nice way to hide them and still allow them to be part of the successful zone. So you've got the two guys up top and then Bam Adebayo. And Bam Adebayo, obviously high-level defensive player, working on some stuff on him this week. And just rangy, athletic, mobile, smart. The coaching in general in this series, and especially Spoelstra, and when you watch the Miami team on both sides of the ball, I think has been top. I mean, Spoelstra's such a great coach. He's been a high-level coach for a very, very long time. And you see that in this series with elements like this. So all of this is to say that I think that zone defense causes problems for the Celtics. And if they can't figure out a way to at least be more efficient or have clear points of attack against it, then it's probably curtains for them because it is such a close series. Otherwise, they need to find a way to create more small advantages. Another way to look at this series is it's very close and we've had two close games and Boston's lost both of those coin flips. So that just completely erodes their series odds. And I do think they are generally in trouble, but I don't know if it's, you know, it's the bubble in Orlando. It's the bubble. I would not say that it's over just yet. One key thing for me with the Celtics was Jason Tatum, especially in game two, looked hesitant's not the right word. He just stopped the ball trying to make particular plays against the zone, and whatever they were working on or whatever their approach was on, when it got to him, things were slow and deliberate. And that's not even a criticism of him as a player. I think one of the things he does so well is he goes quickly, but it looked like he was just searching for making the right play in the zone instead of knowing, you know, that automatic reaction of knowing what you want to do, either drive, shoot, or move the ball. He would get it and hold and jab step and look or think about making a move. And that to me, because of, he's one of the Celtics' key pieces, he along with Kemba, they kind of drive that offense, the two of them. Somebody's got to get untracked there. And I think Tatum adjustments with the decision-making, the way they attack the zone, that could help the Celtics. On the other end, it's been discussed a lot online, great success in the pick and roll with Bam Adebayo and his athleticism rolling and getting behind the way the Celtics are playing that with two people, because the other three guys on the court are hugged up to shooters. And when they're hugged out to these great shooters on the perimeter, not only because of their shooting gravity, right? And as so many will tell you, be quick to tell you, shooting gravity is really about the respect that the defense gives you. And in this case, the Celtics are hugged up not just because of the shooting, but because of the movement. The Heat players cutting, back cutting, relocating, subtle little shifts. They don't stand still. Mo DeKeel had a great little Twitter thread about some of the subtle movement that you'll see that occupies defenders. And that can not only open up a three-point shot, but in the case of that pick and roll that the Heat were having great success with, that can occupy, help defenders. A third guy needs to come in and defend in that pick and roll situation, and you don't have one. Now, if I take a step back on Miami, I do think there's a bigger picture discussion here that maybe I'll be able to get to and put out some content on around, like, the movement of their team, man movement, ball movement, and the perpetual pressure that applies. And to me, I love the fact that they are now a kind of multipolar attacking team. They went from it feels like zero all-stars to three all-stars overnight. So Bam Adebayo is an all-star, Jimmy Butler is an all-star, and Goran Dragic right now, to me, is a clear all-star. We can kind of split hairs, if you want, about his defense and whether he would actually make the 12-person cut or whatever, but he's just playing at that level, and having him as another offensive focal point and the skills that he has, specifically the ability to run that pick and roll, make certain passes, and attack from the top off the dribble, blends really well. You know, you notice how great Miami's team construction is relative to their talent, where putting Duncan Robinson on the court unlocks all these other things. You know, Bam Adebayo's strengths as an offensive player right now, passing, sort of role man ability, offensive rebounding, little mid-range floater stuff as the role man. All of this fits really well with shooters and smart players who can move. So that is always exciting to me, because I feel like I'm always leading the charge on the idea that you don't need an MVP or two MVPs and a bunch of parts to win at the highest level in the NBA. And yes, it's hard to create a super team without superstars, but especially in a year with no super team, you can compete with your 04 Pistons, your 2010 Celtics, just all these teams that just clearly do not have like top five or top 10 players. Now, as I say that, of course, if the Heat were to win the championship, there'd be a massive retrospective push to make Jimmy Butler a top 10 player. He's not top. I don't know. You could argue maybe he cracks the end of the top 10 this year, but let's just make it simple and talk about top five superstar guys. Miami doesn't have one of those, but they do have, as I said, about three all-star players leading the way in their own respect. Bam with his passing and his defense, all the stuff Butler does. Just talked about Dragic. And then the role players, and then the coaching, which is going to get more out of them. And the way the NBA is built now, you go series to series in the postseason, and your coaches need to be able to figure out how to reconfigure the parts and adjust the dials and the knobs so they line up perfectly with the opponent. You got Eric Spoelstra doing that. Just a really, really interesting and exciting team if they were not only to get to the finals, but it's fun to say out loud, win the championship. Speaking of crazy things and winning the championship, the Denver Nuggets. I want to wrap up on them and the Lakers series. Just put out on the Thinking Basketball YouTube channel a video about their offense attacking the Clippers in the comeback stretches of games 5, 6, and 7 of that series. I thought it was fairly symptomatic of the success that Denver has started to be able to find and the weaknesses that I think the Clippers had all year that were never addressed. And the mismatch was a nightmare. One thing I did not mention in that video, I talk about the offensive rating in the comeback quarters in games 5, 6, and 7. So that's the second half of game 5, the second half of game 6, and quarters 2 and 3 in game 7. That's when Denver was down double digits in all of those quarters at the beginning and then surged back by the end of the period I referenced to take the lead. Okay, so here's what I didn't mention. The Nuggets in those 6 quarters had an offensive rating of 142. That translates to 189 points in those 6 quarters. They scored 189 points against the Clippers in 6 quarters. Here were the quarter totals, 38, 29, 34, 30, 28, 30. And what was very impressive to me, 24 shots at the rim. By the way, this is just with Jokic and Murray on the court. There were a bunch of possessions in some of the quarters that they weren't on the court together for, but Denver didn't score that many points. Things were not great on offense when they weren't on the court. But with them on the court, 20 of 24 at the rim, and they shot 52% from downtown. But if you actually regress that down to their average over the season, they still would have had a 124 offensive rating. And I think that is reflective of the balance. You know, they were hurting them in the post. They were hurting them off cuts constantly. If you double-teamed Jokic, you had problems. The ball movement, and even if you're not careful, a little in early offense or transition. So spectacular display by the Nuggets offense. And what I'm really thinking about is how good is this new Jamal Murray? How real is it? How much of it is shooting 49% from downtown? That's not sustainable. When you bring his numbers back down to earth and you look at his strengths and weaknesses as a player and you take out some of the incredible shot making and you just dial it down to something more realistic, how good is he? And we'll have more time to answer that question. But the reason I'm thinking of it today as we go into the series in the West with the Lakers and the Nuggets, and I'll leave with a few thoughts about that matchup. I'm thinking about it today because if Murray is like, I don't know, a top 10, top 15 offensive player legitimately in the league, pull up shooting threat, pretty good passer, nice dynamic off-ball player, gets to the basket, can draw more fouls, his size has really helped him, the 10, 12 pounds he's put on in the last 6 months. If that's basically for real, the way he fits next to Jokic, and as good as Jokic is already as an offensive player, one of the best offensive players in the world, you put those two guys together, and the YouTube thumbnail for the video on them was about how they're the best offensive pairing in the game right now, and I think they would very clearly be the best offensive pairing in the game. And how much of that can you take away if you're a typical defense, and in this case, the Lakers? My instinct was that things would look a lot different with Anthony Davis and LA's size on the court. That was my instinct. I am not so sure. Before recording this, I went through the film on their meeting in the bubble. Lakers and the Nuggets met at the beginning of August in the bubble. And their last game in the regular season before the shutdown, which was at the end of February. I do think with Anthony Davis, this is the perfect opportunity for him as a Swiss Army knife defender to make things harder. But my initial impression was, okay, you've got this giant Laker team. You've got Anthony Davis. You've got Frank Vogel, a good defensive coach. He has a track record of putting in solid game plans. The Lakers have played hard and well on the defensive end all season. And LeBron James, you know, over the summer I contrasted LeBron and Kawhi as defenders, and their strengths and weaknesses, the things they do well, are different from one another. And I think the last series where the Nuggets went against the Clippers, it was a series where Kawhi's weaknesses were more exploited and his strengths were harder to find. That two-man game, Denver's motion, the back cuts. By the way, the Lakers have to be careful about the back cuts. That was one thing that jumped out on film, is the vulnerability to back cutting. But back on track, all of that stuff isn't really designed to be Kawhi Leonard's strength. Handling like 1-5 pick and roll and Jokic post-ups and your responsibility with a bunch of dynamic cutters. Whereas in this series, to me, that is LeBron's strength. LeBron is a better post defender. He's big, and he's really smart and wily off the basketball, making reads. And so you have like this chess match, I guess, where Jokic is trying to look at how the pieces are moving around in real time, as LeBron is on the weak side. That's something I'm looking at. And then there was this incredible dynamic down the stretch of the game in February, where the Nuggets would run pick and roll with Jokic. They would get the switch because Anthony Davis can switch onto Murray pretty well. So sometimes you're okay with that. But on the backside, now Jokic has a little guy on him. And they would throw it to Jokic, and by the time the pass would get there, LeBron James would have switched and he would have been guarding Jokic. It's that old scram move that I talk about all the time with the Celtics, where off the ball, before the pass comes, LeBron yells for, it was Avery Bradley sometimes, it was Caruso, whatever, hey, get out, I'm going to guard Jokic, you come guard my guy. They did this repeatedly. I do think this dynamic is something to watch in this series, but there was an unbelievable play near the end of the fourth quarter where Jokic basically made a touch pass to beat the scram. So pick and roll, they switch, Jokic has a small guy on him, LeBron yells from the opposite block, hey, I'm going to come up and switch. They do that, and as they're doing that and exchanging responsibilities, Jokic catches, turns, Grant cuts from the baseline spot right to the hoop. Very difficult for the defense to contain with that dynamic switching taking place, and it was a layup. That kind of stuff is just going to be fascinating to watch, and when I see that, and I watched the film, and I look at how, yes, the Lakers are going to be much better suited defensively than the Clippers were, in my opinion at least, and what I saw on tape. But the Nuggets, these guys, Jokic and Murray, Murray played well in that February game, and I thought he was better asserting himself in the bubble game, even though he was still getting his legs under him at that point in time. You add in Michael Porter Jr., who wasn't there before. Gary Harris seems to have his groove back. Millsap is an X factor. Steve Jones, friend of the show, said at a certain point he talked himself into Millsap being the X factor in the series, and you can see how, because I think Denver is still going to get a decent amount of what they want to get. Jokic, you can chip away at him, but especially when he's shooting like this, he's so skilled. The pop, the roll, the post up, the passing. He doesn't really roll that much, but you know what I'm getting at. He's just so skilled. And Murray as well was, yes, you can switch Anthony Davis onto Murray and slow that down a little bit, but transition was an issue at times in that early February game, getting back and not allowing Denver to get early stuff, which they'll get to. You think about all the shooters they're going to put on the court with Paul Millsap, if he can shoot the ball well. And I think after look, I know people are getting very excited that I'm going to boldly pick the Nuggets. I've said this before, the uncertainty in the bubble is at an all-time high, and wherever we were, especially in the semifinals, we should have just saturated and soaked ourselves up and bottled that uncertainty, because no matter how obvious that sounds now, in about a month, hindsight bias is going to kick in, and whoever wins will have been the crowned champion, you know, the inevitable champion, and we'll talk about all the things that they did on their run to the championship that were unstoppable. That team is the new key blueprint for building a title, and everyone else has to chase it. I think that's just going to be hindsight bias. I think the uncertainty in the bubble is very high, and it circles back to what we talked about at the beginning of the episode, because the teams are so close together. I do not actually think this Lakers team is significantly better than any of the teams remaining. I do think they provide a completely unique and different kind of matchup in a postseason series, A, because of their defense and size, and B, because they've got two super-duper high-end players left. But one of those high-end players, Anthony Davis, and to a certain degree his value this year, LeBron James, are great, versatile team kind of defenders, well-suited to stop something like this. Yet the something like this in this case, especially if Murray continues to shoot remotely like this, Gary Harris continues to shoot, the something like this with that tandem of Jokic and Murray, that's heavyweight stuff. This isn't, in other words, this isn't going to be, to me, this series where all of a sudden the magic completely stops and they hit a buzzsaw and the Nuggets are wiped off the court in four or five games. I think this is going to be a much, much closer series, and I think there will be moments in the series where Denver's offense gives the Lakers defense problems. And if you get Murray in a lather and he gets going, you can lose a game or two just down the stretch with his momentum and his shot making based on some of those situations. It's going to be close enough that the other side of the ball, which I haven't analyzed in detail, I don't want to present a lot of thoughts on that without a more educated and informed opinion on how they match up. That side of the ball where the Lakers have it on offense, what can the Nuggets do? Can the Nuggets defend successfully enough and not get gashed? You know, Jokic has had moments that have been up and down in these playoffs. And against Utah, spread pick and roll, lots of space on the court. They stretched him out with a pull-up shooter and Mitchell. It gave him problems. The Lakers don't have that. They do have an incredible pick and roll game to fall back on with LeBron and AD, especially if they can get that on an empty side of the court. But that is a different thing than what the Jazz were able to do at certain times to Jokic, and then the rotating Denver defense, recovering Denver defense on the backside. So I actually think we're going to see a lot of these things and more unfold in this series. And I've kind of recalibrated my mind on this. I think this is going to be a much closer series, a relatively close back and forth series, and I can certainly see Denver winning it. Man, a Miami-Denver finals. That would just be the icing on the cake, just from a chaotic narrative, crazy 2020 season bubble story. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. We will see. Game one is tonight. That's enough talking for me from today. Hope you enjoyed this one. Hope you're enjoying the NBA playoffs. Remember to check out theathletic.com/thinkingbasketballpod for 40% off. Don't forget the pod at the end of that. Let me know more of your playoff thoughts, more questions for next week's episode on Twitter at LG35. Tag me with topic ideas or questions that you want to hear me address as we crescendo toward the 2020 NBA Finals, Conference Finals in full swing. To support this show, to support everything Thinking Basketball, head on over to patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. We just did our most recent live Q&A last week, and we're going to do another one coming up before the season is over. All kinds of extra content over there as well. Subscriber-only videos that don't make it to YouTube. We have a discussion forum with all kinds of historical back and forth, statistical database, things like that. It's patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. Thanks so much to all those Patreon subscribers who make this possible. Hope you're enjoying these playoffs once again, and wherever you are, that you're having a great day.